Hello and welcome back to the podcast. If you're new here, I'm Sheen, your host. And you know that when we have a man on the podcast, he needs to deserve to be here. And I'm super excited to welcome someone super special today. So please join me in welcoming Sahil Bloom. If you haven't seen his viral clips, you haven't read his viral tweets, you might have seen his best-selling book online already, which we're going to talk about today. But for now, welcome Sahil. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me and for the kind intro. I appreciate it.
So, you know, I want to start with by saying how I came across your content. And I just want to give context to the audience. The first time I saw your content, it was you in an ice bath. Yeah. Telling me that someone who is less qualified than me is making a lot more money than me because I'm wasting my time being overthinking instead of taking actions. It was very early, Sahil. I really did not need that. And I was like, okay, great. I forgot about it. And then a few days later, I see you again on my feed. This time you're making some really depressing maths with me about how I have less than 15 trips left home to see my parents if I go home once a year. I was like, okay, traumatizing, but the breadth of the content is incredible. So that's when I decided to click and I followed you since then. And I have to say the way you break things down and make us think about life is pretty cool.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's funny when you put it into context of like what the first two pieces of content were that you saw and how different those two things were. It brings it into striking form, that exact point of the breadth of the things that I talk about. You know, I have often thought that the greatest discoveries in life come not from finding the right answers, but from asking the right questions. And when I think of the content and the ideas that I try to share, whether videos, writing, this book, any of the different things I'm putting out, what I'm trying to do is help people ask better questions about their life. Because I fundamentally believe that everyone out there already has the answers inside of them somewhere. But you haven't asked the right question yet to uncover that answer, to act on that answer in your life. I think about the biggest transformations I've had in my own journey. They haven't been about not having the answer. They've been about the fact that it hasn't been revealed through asking the right question. And so that is really what I'm trying to do when I put things out into the world.
Yeah, I love that. So the first thing I want to talk to you about is I think me and you have had a very eerily similar trajectory of going to what is considered elite universities, went into the corporate world, and then decided, you know, we need something a bit more impactful, more entrepreneurship driven, and more creative as well now. But I think for people like us, that change is not just a career move. It's an actual, almost personality and identity shift, right? So at what point in your career did you realize that, you know, this is the point I'm going to disappoint all the LinkedIn bros and get off the corporate ladder?
It is an act of rebellion.
Right?
It takes so much courage to choose a different path in a world that rewards you for following the default one. Mm-hmm. I have often thought that the person who can tolerate the most uncertainty is the person who eventually wins. And there is so much to be gained by being the type of person who can continue to show up when the rewards are uncertain. And that is what it demands when you step off a traditional track. Because in the traditional track, whatever that is, you know exactly what the rewards look like.
Oh, yeah.
You know the path. You know where you're going to be 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years from now. And there's a lot of comfort from that. And the world pats you on the back for just continuing to march down that. There's a lot of gravity to it. And to your point of the LinkedIn bros, not all that joking, you get patted on the back publicly for just continue for doing the post, the annual promotion, the annual thing, whatever the thing is. I stepped off the track because I realized that if I continued on it, I was going to end up somewhere where I didn't want to be. And for me, that was really about this recognition that I was winning the battle, but I was going to lose the war. There's this concept of the Pyrrhic victory, which is the victory that comes at such a steep cost to the victor that it might as well have been a defeat. It's the idea of the battle won, but the war lost. And many of us are marching towards a Pyrrhic victory in our life. We are going to win the battle, which is money. It's the one thing that we all get told really matters, that we should be marching towards the status, the money, the things that you're told you should want. And you may win that battle. But if you win that battle at the expense of the much bigger war of building a fulfilling life, a happy, fulfilling, rewarding, joyful, meaningful life, it isn't worth it. You win the battle, but you lose that bigger war. And that was the path that I was marching down. I was working in the world of investing, getting the annual promotion, getting the bonus, all of the things that the world tells you you should want. And frankly, the things that like made me sound impressive, that made it seem like from the outside looking in, I was winning the game. And people told me that. Like people were looking at me, patting me on the back, all of the status, all of the things. And I got to the point where I started to realize that if that was what winning the game felt like, I had to be playing the wrong game. Because all of these other areas of my life were starting to suffer. I was making money, I was doing the things, but my relationships were starting to fall apart. I was seeing my parents once a year. My relationship with my sister was really struggling. My wife and I were struggling to conceive at the time. That was creating strain in our life. I was drinking 6 or 7 nights a week. My physical health, my mental health were suffering. All of these other things in my life were starting to deteriorate, while on the outside looking in, everything was going great. And it all came to a head for me with a single conversation, which you referenced relative to that one video that you saw. I went out for a drink with an old friend and he asked how I was doing. And I told him that it had started to get difficult living so far away from my parents who were getting older. They were living on the East Coast, 3,000 miles away. And he asked how old they were. And I said, mid-60s. And he asked how often I saw them. And I said, about once a year at that point. And he looked at me and said, okay, so you're going to see your parents 15 more times before they die. And I just remember feeling like I'd been punched in the gut. I actually had to take a deep breath to avoid an instinctively angry response. But it was a good friend. It wasn't that he was trying to be mean or rude. It was just math.
Yeah.
They're mid-60s. I was seeing them once a year and they might live until they're 80. I was going to see them 15 more times. It was countable. It was finite. And in that moment, I realized very clearly and viscerally that if something didn't change, I was going to end up living that Pyrrhic victory. I was going to win this one battle, but at the expense of everything else in my life. And so the next day, my wife and I had a very candid conversation about what we wanted to be our center, what our true north really was, what we were trying to build our life around. And within 45 days, I had left this job, this high status, high paying job. We had sold our house in California and we had moved 3,000 miles across the country to live closer to our families.
Wow. And to a lot of people, that feels like it's a very brave decision, right? But it's probably the best decision you've made in your life. Did you ever look back after that?
Yeah, I think that it is a dramatic decision. It is one that, from the outside looking in, again, looks like this, oh my God, you know, you just like jumped out of the plane and like hope that you land safely.
Yeah.
The underneath the surface version of it was a little bit different. You know, I had for a long time been feeling this slow, steady deterioration. And then this one striking event happened of this conversation. So like Ernest Hemingway was once asked how he went bankrupt and he said gradually, then suddenly. And that was really what happened. It was gradually these changes were happening in my life. And then suddenly this one conversation was what set it off that I needed to make a change. And a lot of people ask me like, oh, you were walking away from a lot of things. And what I always say is, yes, I was walking away from a lot of things, but I was walking in to so much more. We always say this phrase, like never leave money on the table. Everyone says that. They're like, oh, never leave money on the table. But you never think twice about leaving peace of mind on the table, leaving your emotional
your health
on the table,
leaving
your energy on the table. We leave all those things on the table. Mm. We make these decisions to prioritize money. We need to reframe that in our minds. Yes, I was leaving a lot behind by making this decision financially in certain ways. But I was walking into so much more that has enabled me to do better in all of these areas of life because I'm leaning into the things that I actually care about. I'm building a life around the things I care about. I'm marching up a mountain that I actually care to be on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And during that journey to make that transition possible, what do you think was the biggest thing about yourself that you had to unlearn?
That everything I had believed about what a successful life looked like was wrong.
Mm.
I fundamentally think that we live in a speed-obsessed world. We live in this world where you're told that doing more and more and more, faster and faster and faster, is the way to achieve a successful life, to build a wealthy life. And what I've learned now is that direction is so much more important than speed. It's much better to climb slowly up the right mountain than it is to climb fast up the wrong one. And so many people never take even one moment to ask themselves, is this a mountain that I actually care to be on? Is this a mountain that I want to be at the top of?
Mm.
Because you're moving so fast that you don't have time. You don't have the energy or the time to step back and ask yourself whether you actually care to be on this mountain. Or is it one that I've just been handed and taken as my own?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of life is about that. It's about the fact that we blindly accept these assumptions about what matters in our life and about what we should care about and focus on.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that we start learning when we're a kid that get further entrenched in school, that get even more entrenched in university, and then you take your job and you're just set on a path for your entire life. And I've often said that the worst thing in the world is not being on a bad path. The worst thing in the world is being on a good path that isn't yours. Because a bad path screams at you every single day to step off of
yeah.
it. You know, as soon as you're on a bad path, everything in the world is like, you have to get off this path. You have to make a change. So it's actually easier mm-hmm. to do that. The good path that isn't yours, there's a whole lot of forces telling you to stay on it. There's bills that you're able to pay. There are people telling you that you're doing great.
Mm-hmm.
There's people patting you on the back for it. There's the LinkedIn likes. All of those things are telling you to stay on the path that mm-hmm. you're on. But it's not yours. And you know that deep down, but you don't allow yourself the time to actually sit with that and think about what is the path that I want to be walking down? And what is my path to making that change?
Quick break for a word from today's sponsor. Are you looking to turn global trends into trading opportunities? Meet Pepperstone, where top-tier trading tech meets competitive pricing. Trade Forex, commodities, shares, and indices with ultra-low spreads starting from zero on a Razor account. Fast execution? Check. 24/5 support? Check. Plus, you can trade on MetaTrader, CTrader, TradingView, and more. And don't worry, they're fully regulated by top financial authorities worldwide. So why wait? Trade smarter with Pepperstone today. There's a link in my bio for you to check it out, and a huge shout out to Pepperstone for supporting Building Wealth for Women through this podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think that what also is leading people into the hustle culture, where even now, so I have a business partner and she quit her investment banking job as well. And she started feeling a lot of guilt for not working 24/7, even though the business is making a lot more money than what her salary is. But she's like, I don't know. I just don't feel challenged. I don't feel productive. And there's that misconception between productivity and busyness at this point. And again, it's because, as you said, we are all so busy into just following what has been told, right?
The single greatest challenge for any ambitious person is to reframe rest and free time as part of your performance, not as a reward for your efforts. The number of ambitious people that I meet who feel guilty for having free time and rest as part of their life,
mm-hmm.
it's terrifying. You think about it, and it's so important. The best ideas that you have, the biggest business ideas, the most creative ideas for your work, all of those things come during those periods of boredom.
Mm-hmm.
Truly, during those periods of boredom, when you're in the shower,
mm-hmm.
when you're driving in the car, when you're out on a walk, that's when you have your best ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's not while you're like grinding away, sending emails.
No.
It's certainly not while you're scrolling on social media. It's while you're allowing your mind to actually have space when there's no stimulus and there's no responses needing to go out. That's when you're most creative. We know this scientifically, actually. Stanford researchers did this study where they had people walk and then they tested their creative output.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw that there was a 60% improvement in creative divergent thinking during and after walking than without walking.
Mm.
Like walking actually sparks creative, deep thinking.
Wow.
But we don't think about the fact that we need to create that space mm-hmm. in our life in order to have those moments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But okay, I want to move to the book now that we're talking about these things. So obviously, congratulations, first of all. How does it feel to have it here physically now?
You want me to be honest?
Yes, please.
So the book was published a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
on Monday. So the book came out on a Tuesday. On Monday, everything was great on the surface. I walked into Times Square that morning in New York City, and there was a billboard with a picture of my book and my face on it. My whole family came out. We had this huge launch event, sold out crowd, hundreds of people telling me how great I was, that the book was amazing, that my words had inspired them. All of these reasons to feel really good and confident. I went home that night and was caught in the grips of probably the worst anxiety, stress, and fear that I've ever experienced in my life. Could not sleep the entire night, was awake the entire night. The next day, rather than feeling this joy and excitement and accomplishment at this moment, this big moment, I was in a dark, deep hole of self-doubt the entire day. That feeling of fear of being found out, that this was the moment everyone was going to realize that I was a fraud, that I'm an imposter, that I don't belong, that I'm not an author. I was caught in like a dark spiral. And my wife was like, oh, aren't you happy? I was like, I was feeling this deep, deep feeling of imposter syndrome all day. And it was such an interesting experience to me to recognize that when on the surface, everything is telling you that you should feel great about the thing. People are telling me the book is great, all of these things. It didn't matter. Internally, that story that I was telling myself, this negative story, was just spiraling. And the recognition there is that when you experience that in your own life, anyone out there that's listening to this, you are not alone. It is, I mean, unfathomable when you're feeling that to think about the fact that someone that you admire, someone that you look up to, also feels that same way still, that it never goes away. The first thing I did the next day when I was trying to navigate it was I sent texts to the most successful people in my life, all of these mentors, friends, people, Fortune 100 CEOs, famous actors and musicians, authors, asking them how they dealt with that when they felt it earlier in their career. And what they all said was it never went away. They still feel it. The CEO giving the keynote in front of hundreds of millions of people watching around the world still feels that same feeling of imposter syndrome that you feel when you're doing your first thing at the start of your career. Mm-hmm. And that was such a reminder and an aha moment to me in that of like, oh, this is natural. This is normal. And importantly, you asked for this. This is the cost of entry for the growth that you asked for. You asked for this growth in your life, so you have to pay the cost of entry of feeling like the imposter, because the thing that you're trying to get to, that personal transformation, that growth, is on the other side of you paying this cost of entry.
You know, this reminded me, I'm going to name drop, but I filmed with Bill Gates once, and we were interviewing female farmers in Kenya, and I remember I was telling him, you're used to this, right? This is something. He was like, no, I feel like the biggest imposter here because I know nothing about this topic, but I have to pretend I do. And I was like, well, people can't tell. He was like, yeah, I've had years of practice. Mm. And again, as you said, it's so important for us to know that even someone like you, who from the outside, we all think, oh, wow, you must be rolling with this. But it's good to hear that that's how you feel. But how do you deal with it then? How do you come out with it other than, yes, you said you speak to other people, you understand that everyone else deals with it, but is there a way for us to be better prepared when that wave is about to hit?
I had a coaching session with myself. This is an idea that I got from a friend of mine, Alex Hormozi is his name, big internet creator, writer. And we had a conversation and he was telling me about this idea of doing a coaching session with yourself. And so I tried it. And what I did was I sent an email to myself and I wrote out what I was feeling. And I said, I'm struggling with this idea of imposter syndrome. And then I replied and said, okay, let's deconstruct it a little bit. What are you actually feeling? And so it forced me to sit and actually articulate, okay, let me get it out of inside of me and write it down of what am I feeling? What am I actually worried about? And then I responded to that from the outside looking in, big picture, zoomed out perspective. What would I say to myself in this moment? The reason it's so powerful to do that is because it fights back against something called Solomon's paradox, which is the idea that we are very good at giving clear, rational advice to other people and very bad at embracing that same clear, rational advice ourselves. So we'll give good advice, but then we can't take that mm-hmm. same advice ourselves. What this forces you to do is it takes you out of yourself so that you can act as though you're giving advice to yourself. Mm-hmm. And then it's much easier. Now I'm able to actually embrace it into my life. It helped enormously. I felt a little bit crazy sitting there typing emails to myself, but it was like a live journaling session with a therapist, but the therapist was me. And I thought in that moment, like, this is such an interesting practice for people to develop. Because again, to the point earlier, you already have the answers. You just need to zoom out enough to be able to act on them and to mm-hmm. be able to move forward with them. So I think that that is a really interesting practice that people can adopt. Anytime you are like really struggling with something, people tell you to journal, but this is sort of a second layer on journaling to actually zoom out from the self so that you can see the bigger picture. Like, mm-hmm. I'm here. I'm doing the thing that my younger self would have dreamed about, would have prayed for. And I'm here in the moment struggling around it, but I need to be able to zoom out, see that bigger picture of how far we've come, of the thing that I'm achieving right now, and how I asked for this growth, mm-hmm. so I have to be willing to pay the cost of entry to achieve it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're going to laugh, but I do that with ChatGPT.
That's actually good. That's a great way of doing right? it. Yeah.
I saw someone mention it on TikTok being like, just tell ChatGPT you want them to be a therapist or a coach or something. Tell them what the problem is and ask you the right questions. Mm. Really makes you think. And I had the same thing of structuring, especially it came to where trying to strategize about the year, and it really helped asking the right questions. So I think you giving the answer again is always really good. Love that.
I wonder whether you could train ChatGPT in your voice as like your future self.
You can.
I would probably try to do that. That seems like an interesting idea. I might actually toy around with that to like create an 80-year-old version of Sahil who has lived, you know, his full life and has all the same perspectives and ideas, but is able to see the zoomed out view and give me advice from the perspective of my older self.
That would be cool.
That would be cool.
You should try it.
Yeah, I might try that. I'll follow up with you. I'll let you know.
Let me know how it goes. But okay, for people who haven't come across the five types of wealth, what is the quickest way for you to explain this to them and also to do a self audit for us to know where is some place where we're winning and where are some place where we're broke in the five types of wealth?
So the whole idea with the book is that we have narrowly defined wealth as being about money mm-hmm. as a society. It is the one thing that's so measurable that everyone focuses on it. And what happens is you focus on it so narrowly that you lose sight of everything else. And money isn't nothing. It simply can't be the only thing. Money is great. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not telling anyone that they should like give up all their possessions and go live in the Himalayas drinking warm broth and meditating 12 hours a day. If you want to do that, by all means, do it. I'm just not going to be joining you. Mm-hmm. I like money. I just can't have it and focus on it at the expense of everything else mm-hmm. in my life. The concept of these five different types is fundamentally about identifying what truly matters to you. And then going and taking action to build your life around those things. Mm. My answer to that question is going to be different than yours. Mm-hmm. It's going to be different than anyone out there listening to this. The point is that you need to identify those things. Identify the things that truly matter to you, not what the world tells you you should care about, not what your family tells you, not what your friends tell you, and certainly not what social media tells you, but what you truly care about, and then go and take tiny actions today to start building your life around those things. It is also about a recognition that these areas of your life can be invested in on a daily basis in the same way that you think about investing in your financial wealth. We know when it comes to financial wealth that putting away $50 or $100 today is mm-hmm. a good investment because it's going to compound. You put it into an index fund, close your eyes, mm-hmm. 30 years go by and it's worth a lot more. So mm-hmm. a tiny investment today compounds and grows into the future. The same rule applies to all of these areas of your life. Investments in your relationships today, tiny investments compound over the long run. Mm-hmm. Tiny investments in your health compound over the long run. But we don't think about these other areas of our life in that same way. And we need to, mm-hmm. because what that means is that you don't ever turn them off. I might be prioritizing and focusing on financial wealth in this season of my life. Maybe I'm in my 20s, early 30s, and I'm building that foundation. It's important. Mm-hmm. But I can't turn off these other areas. I can't flip the switch off. Mm-hmm. I can turn it down on a dimmer switch, mm-hmm. if you will, because anything above zero compounds positively. Sending the one text to the friend when you're thinking about them is better than doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Going for the 15-minute walk is better than doing nothing. But that requires an understanding that these are investments and that they stack. And those tiny little wins stack up and grow into your future. That is fundamentally the way that you change your life. It is by making these tiny investments, designing these things into your life, and getting rid of the word later. Later is the single most dangerous word in the dictionary. You say, I'll spend more time with my kids later. I'll prioritize my health later. I'll focus on my relationship with my partner or my friends later. I'll find my freedom and purpose later. And the sad thing is that later just becomes another word for never, because those things are not going to exist in the same way later. Your kids are not going to be 5 years old later. Mm-hmm. Your health won't be there later if you don't invest in it now. Your relationships won't be there later. You won't magically wake up with freedom and purpose later. So either you design those things into your life in some tiny way now, those tiny investments on a daily basis, or you're just going to regret it later.
Wow. And for you, which of these five types of wealth was the hardest one to come to terms with?
I would say that the biggest change that I needed to make was social wealth, was relationships, primarily with my parents and my sister. I had allowed this pursuit of money and status to blind me to the fact that the amount of time I had left with those people in my life, the amount of moments, was so finite and so much lower than I ever cared to admit. And rekindling and regrowing those relationships has been the most powerful and life-enhancing thing that I can imagine. I mean, I see my parents, right? Like that number 15 more times before they die. Now it's in the hundreds. Yeah. I see my parents multiple times a month. They're a huge part of my son, their grandson's life. We took an action and literally created time with the people that we care about. My sister, just being totally open, my sister and I had a pretty challenged relationship for most of my life. She's older, 3.5 years older. We had a very competitive relationship. She was very high achieving academically. She was doing all of the things that an Indian mother and a Harvard professor father would want their kid to do.
The star child.
Yeah, the star child. Yeah. She's the golden child. And I was sort of the younger, like, ne'er-do-well brother that, like, played sports and I was, like, not studying. And I grew to resent her for the fact that she was accomplishing these things. She grew to resent me for the fact that she thought my parents took it too easy on me. And so we created this tense dynamic really grounded in my insecurity, the fact that I started to think that I wasn't that smart, and so I took it out on her. And what that led to was that by the time I was 30, we basically had no relationship, basically didn't talk. It wasn't outwardly tense and like fighting, but we basically didn't have a relationship. And that is such a sad thing, because your sibling is the one person that truly sees you throughout the entire course of your life, that truly knows you. And that all changed. We made this move. We prioritized being closer to the people that we care about. And there was a single moment that for me changed all of it. When my son was born, my whole family came down to sort of welcome us home from the hospital. And my sister had had her first child, a boy as well, 11 months before ours. And we took this picture where I'm holding my son and my sister is holding her son. It was the two of us. And I looked over at my sister as we were taking this picture. And I just remember feeling like I could see her for the first time. There was no pretenses. There was no resentment. There was nothing. None of the prior stuff mattered. It was like I was meeting my sister for the first time in my life. And from that moment on, our relationship has fundamentally changed. I opened up to her about the fact that I had created this tension. She opened up to me around that. And I feel like now this relationship has blossomed into one of incredible depth in this new season of life. And it's a reminder that sometimes you will have a loving, deep relationship with someone that you haven't even met yet. There are certain seasons of your life where relationships will just blossom for no reason, nothing that you can possibly point to, but for some reason, it's the right person at the right time. So leaning into those relationships, leaning into that energy when it comes, is such a joy-creating and life-enhancing thing.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Sahil. And it's so nice to hear that. I also have an older sister, high achieving. She is proper corporate girl. And I had a bigger age gap, 6 years. So growing up, I also resented her. She felt like she was my bully and I'm always trying to get out of her shadow. But then afterwards, now she's like my biggest best friend. But for us, the switch happened when she left home for uni and we were no longer living in the same house. And I guess sisters are different as well, different relationship. But that's beautiful. Mm. And I feel like I love how openly you are about, you share things that are very emotional. And it feels like you are very in touch with your emotional health, right? Of how you feel about things, how relationships impact you. And given, you know, the context of the podcast as well, we have a big female audience. I know that there are three pivotal women in your life, your mum, your sister, and your wife. Mm. So you've told us a little bit about your sister. I would love to hear how your mum and your wife, Elizabeth, have also impacted your life at different stages.
Yeah, my mom is a special, special woman. I think she is really where my like storytelling bug comes from. My mom is an incredible storyteller. Throughout my whole life, I feel like my mom has always been sort of like life of the party type person. She's like the type of person who has probably 30 people in the world who think of her as their best friend.
Right.
For whatever reason, she's always been that way. And she's also someone who has very high standards and high expectations, but pairs those high expectations with very high support. Mm. And that to me, I would characterize as the two pillars of strong relationships. High expectations are to say, I believe you are capable of incredible things. I have high expectations for you to be at that level. But pairing that with high support as the second pillar, meaning I'm willing to lift you up to go and meet those expectations that I have for you. One without the other is a recipe for trouble. Mm. High expectations with no support is a recipe for resentment.
Yeah.
We've been in relationships like that. We know that. But the two paired together is a recipe for incredible things. So I'm so grateful to my mom for always holding me to those high standards, but then being there, standing in the front row, helping lift me up to go and achieve those. And she has just been an incredible force in that way in my life. And then my wife, I mean, we don't have enough time for me to talk about my wife and the ways that she's impacted my life. We met when she was 14. I was 15. We've been dating since high school, since we met. She was 15, technically, when we started dating. And she has seen me through these different seasons of life and these changes and this journey and believed in me at times when I didn't believe in myself. I posted a screenshot of this text message that I got from her yesterday. She texted me just out of the blue saying she was really proud of me. And I responded and said, how funny is all of this? Like, I feel like I kind of just manifested this book. Like when, like a few years ago, I started on this journey and now there's this thing in the world. People seem to be impacted by it. It's amazing. And she was like, I never doubted it for a second. Like when you decide you want to do something, you just go do it, period. And I was just reflecting on how amazing it is to have someone in your life who believes in you, even in moments when you don't believe in yourself. We spend so much of our life looking for permission from other people to do things, like looking for that one person who can tap us in so that we can step into the arena and step into the game because we're too scared to do it in our own moment. And when you find someone that can be your partner in life, that it is that for you, that is like coming constantly and saying like, go do the thing, go tap you in. She was the one that encouraged me to go down this different path. And when I was like stressed and so scared about what this change was going to be, she was the one that said, can't you do this writing, the thing that you're doing that you seem to love so much? Isn't that like a job? Can't you build something around that? She was the one that empowered that. And now, I mean, seeing her in this new light as a mother to our son, and the journey that it took to get there with infertility and the struggles that we had around that, I think she's the most incredible woman in the world. I mean, I would not be anywhere without her.
That's beautiful. And I love her. Every time you talk about her, your eyes sparkle. She should be so happy to see that and hear that. And I think it's beautiful how you've outlined how different stages of your life, these three women have shaped you in different ways. But of course, now you're also a father. That has also shaped you in a different way. You're raising your son in a very different world to the one where you grew up, right? So how do you think this has impacted you as a man?
It probably comes across as we're having this discussion, but I have a very different view on masculinity than I would say you what do. Social media proposes masculinity looks like. I feel a responsibility in a lot of ways to share, you know, these more vulnerable and emotion forward things about my life, because on the surface, you might look at me and say like, oh, you know, typical guy. And then I say things and I'm openly willing to, you know, cry about relationships with people and our infertility struggles. These different things that you just aren't used to seeing a guy talk about. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, this is weird. This looks different. And the reason I think it's so important is because there are a lot of men out there who don't feel like they have a real role model for what building a good life looks like. Mm. We have attached ourselves as a society, men in particular, to this standard of masculinity that actually is just misogyny and like outwardly disgusting behavior in disguise. And we're calling it masculinity.
Yep.
And it's embarrassing and it's toxic and it's dangerous. And I feel a responsibility to shine a light on a very different view of what it means to be a good man. And a huge part of that is how I feel in my role as a father, in being able to show up every single day for my wife and for my son, and to try to be the best version that I can be. That doesn't mean that I am the best, but I'm going to try every single day. And with my son in particular, what I think about the most is that you can't teach your kids anything. You just have to embody the things that you want them to learn. And me embodying and living the way that I want him to embrace is the most important thing. If I want my son to treat my wife like a queen, I better damn well treat my wife like a queen. If I want my son to understand the value of delayed gratification, I better do hard things every single day in order to achieve the outcomes that I want. I'm not going to teach him those things. I'm not going to be able to sit down and explain to him mm-hmm. why they matter. I have to live by them, and then he's going to learn from seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really important. But at the same time, right, Sahil, I feel like throughout this conversation, that's what I was thinking when you were talking, is that it seems like you have everything under control. And I'm sure you have your own hard days. There are times when things don't go to plan. How do you course correct in these situations?
I have plenty of tough days. There's this analogy of like a duck. I don't know if you've ever like heard this analogy. It's like a duck like looks very calm and beautiful on the surface, but underneath it's like, you know, kicking its feet like super, super fast to stay afloat. I sort of feel like that a lot of the time. Like I'm doing a whole lot under the surface that no one really sees. The outside world might not see. Course correction to me is about creating the space necessary to pause.
Mm.
I think it's very hard to course correct while you're moving. If you're moving really, really fast, it's just naturally very difficult to properly course correct because A, you can't actually see where you're headed. You don't have a clear view of like, oh, I'm off course. Mm. If you're moving, it's very hard. You need to like pause, right? Like if you're thinking about like while you're on a hike, you're trying to like climb someplace, mm-hmm. you're exploring. Like explorers weren't trying to create the map and figure out where they were while they're walking,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you stop, you look at the stars, you like create, look at the map, you get your compass out, you do certain things to course correct.
Yeah.
So I really believe that we have to do the same thing. You have to pause enough to see where you're off base, to see what's going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
On a daily basis, if you're having an issue and you're like, whoa, things are spiraling, just go for a 5-minute walk. I have never had a single problem get worse by going for a walk or doing a workout. I really haven't. I mean, working out is an investment in your mental health just as much as your physical.
Mm.
Going for a walk is an investment in your mental health just as much as your physical. These things create the space so that you can just slow down life a little bit. What happens is when you start to spiral, when you start to feel things going wrong during a day, you start making emotion-induced decisions, and those are always the worst. So many relationships have been broken. So many actions have been taken that have ruined lives in the heat of an emotion-induced decision or moment. Pausing for 5 minutes really helps avoid that.
Okay. And we are getting to the end now. I have two final questions for you. One of them is I ask all everyone is if you were to introduce yourself without mentioning where you're from, your ethnicity, your education, or what you do as a job, who is Sahil?
A husband and father.
Oh.
Yeah, I would go to that. I mean, I never know how to introduce myself, and so I actually feel like stay-at-home dad is probably, like, I technically am a stay-at-home dad. Yeah. I happen to be doing work while I'm at home, but I'm technically a stay-at-home dad, so maybe I'd go to that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And how did you find the transition from, you know, someone who was probably working long hours in the office and now working from home?
I'm working long hours at home.
Change of location.
That's one of the most the funniest misconceptions about entrepreneurship. People are like, "Oh, I'm gonna own my time. This is gonna be great." I'm like,
No.
You're actually just gonna work more, and you're gonna be more stressed
because
now it's
anymore.
On you. Yeah, like no one's telling you what to do. You just have to do it. The transition for me to being at home. At times, difficult. I mean, there's a lot of loneliness on the entrepreneurial journey. A lot of people that you previously understood and spoke the same language as will no longer understand what you're talking about or what you're doing or why you care about those things. And I've had many moments in the last several years where people that I looked up to, people that were mentors, people that were friends, thought that I was crazy for the things that I was doing. Now I have something out in the world where it's like, okay, it's more permanent. It's real. People understand it. You're a writer. You're an author. There's a book. But like writing tweets on the internet or like posting videos, you're like, oh, you're an influencer. That's cute, right? Like people make comments like
of
that.
Course.
You go to something and they're like, oh, you're doing that influencer thing or you're doing that little thing.
The
you know, they like belittle
thing.
You
yeah,
with
yeah.
the little words.
Yeah.
And it's very lonely. And so one thing that I have found has really helped is just like finding your community of other people that are on those similar paths to you can really help during those moments of loneliness.
But I feel like there is a bit of a waiting time, right, before you find the next group of people.
It's the worst. I mean, I think of it as these seasons of loneliness. And in particular, periods of loneliness are a tax on personal transformation. What I mean by that is they are literally the cost of entry for the transformation that you want. Because by definition, as you start to change, the environment that you previously fit into is no longer going to match who you are as a person. You are literally going to be speaking a different language than the people that you were previously around. But you have yet to attract the new people into your world. So you're caught in the middle. And that is the season of loneliness. That is this period that you're in. Embracing that and understanding that it is a season and that it will end and that it is part of the process of this transformation that you are asking for, this growth that you've prayed for. That really helped me on the journey. And I think it'll help others.
And Sahil, after all of this is done, what is the legacy? What do you want to be known as, remembered as?
I would love for people to say that I had some tiny impact on their life. I don't care all that much about money, which is kind of a weird thing to say. I feel like to a certain extent, I have enough. I'm living my enough life. I don't need to make $1 billion. I'm not striving towards that. If I do, it's because I created an enormous impact on people's lives. And it's a byproduct of that, not that I was chasing it. And so I am really focused for however long that I get to be around on doing that, on creating an impact on people's lives, on feeling like, I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson said that some one person breathed easier for you being around. That's kind of the definition of success. And I would love to be able to say that at the end of my days.
Yeah, and your definition of success must have changed over time, isn't it? Massively.
Enormously.
And do you think it will still change? It will.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I think that you change. We said this at the beginning of this discussion that part of this is like identity shifts and who you are as a person, what you care about. part of the beauty of this whole idea of five types of wealth is that this is going to shift for you. If you read this book at when you're 20, you're going to read it very differently than when you're 50, mm-hmm. than when you're 70, than when you're 90, mm-hmm. because you are fundamentally a changing creature. The things that you are excited about focusing on building around are going to change. The mm-hmm. questions remain the same, but the answers change. Mm-hmm. And what your purpose is, what your calling is, what your energy is leaning into during any one season, that is going to shift. But the important point is that you have a sense of the true north, like what you are really trying to build around for the entire journey that you're on.
Mm-hmm. And what's next for you now on this journey?
I want to go deeper on these ideas in the world. I want to spend time with people who are taking them, who are running with them in different ways. And I want to get out actually in person with those people. Social media is sort of a thing that I have to do, not mm-hmm. something that I really love doing. Mm-hmm. I love writing. And I love spending time with people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to spend much more time with people in the coming few years.
Okay, well, I hope you come to Dubai to spend some more time with people.
I will do that. I will do that.
Okay, and what's your parting message, any advice you have for the audience, anyone who's listening?
Oof. Reject the default assumptions that you've been handed for your life. Reject all of the paths that you've been handed. Reject all of the answers that other people have given you, and just take a time to question them. Just take 1 second to ask yourself whether they are actually the things that you want in your life. Identify what you truly want, and then tomorrow, wake up in the morning and go take some tiny action to build your life around those things.
Sahil, thank you so much for being here. This was a lovely conversation. I hope you had fun.
I had a blast. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, good luck with the book, and hopefully see you soon in Dubai.
Look forward to it.